Good morning. This is Ozarks at Large for Sunday, December 22nd, 2013. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. Ahead on this edition of Weekend Ozarks, we visit a yarn shop to visit with local knitters about how and what they're working on this holiday season.
Plus, a conversation with a local man who lost his grandson in the Sandy Hook massacre last December. And how a church reaches out to the community with its healing touch.
But first, you've developed a bad cough and worry it might be bronchitis. Your primary care physician is booked for the next week, so you decide to visit the local urgent care center. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, such walk-in clinics are convenient, affordable, and will likely be in greater demand because of healthcare reform.
We have 24 urgent care centers in Arkansas. 4 are in the Arkansas River Valley, 5 in central Arkansas, and 5 in northwest Arkansas. 2 MediServe walk-in clinics operated by MANA, that's Medical Associates of Northwest Arkansas, Ozark Urgent Care in Bentonville, and Caris Urgent Care, which operates clinics in Lowell and Fayetteville near the busy University of Arkansas. Dr. Robert Caris worked as an emergency room physician for 3 local hospitals before opening his own urgent care practice 2 years ago. Business is brisk.
Anywhere from 15 to 30 at each clinic.
That's per day. Most of his patients range in age from 20 to 50. His Lowell patients are primarily Hispanic. Dr. Caris will not accept patients with chest pain, stroke symptoms, severe abdominal pain, and chronic pain, referring them to local emergency rooms. But he does treat everything else.
Some people we do some primary care with, like blood pressure and diabetes, but mainly like if they're young and pretty healthy and, like, say they go out and they get injured or they hurt themselves, they come in and we'll take care of them. Or if they, get a sinus infection or bronchitis or something like that, we could cover them for that. Sometimes we treat people for abdominal pain. They'll come in and we'll treat them for that. Bladder infections are pretty common. Strep throat's common.
Staff create electronic medical records for each patient for continuity of care. But unlike many urgent care centers, Caris is a cash-only clinic, another medical industrial complex novelty.
We don't file insurance. That's what we tell everybody when all our front desk people. It's important. When people call and ask, do you take insurance? Don't say no. We say we don't file insurance. We'll give them an itemized statement that they can turn in and send into their insurance company. They'll get reimbursed just like they went to the regular doctor's office.
Not filing insurance saves his clinic both money and time, Dr. Caris says.
The reason why we do that is so that we can get you in and out. We can see you within 20 minutes usually, get you in and out. It's not triple layers of paperwork and this and that and, wait in the waiting room, wait to see the doctor, wait to leave. It's just walk right back in, get out, and then hopefully go get better.
Caris Urgent Care Center fees are transparent, posted on the clinic's website. A single visit for a cough or sore throat costs $60 for a child, $70 for an adult. A simple laceration, $85. X-rays cost $50. Lab costs range between $30 and $50. So with millions of Americans and hundreds of thousands of Arkansans enrolling in private insurance on the healthcare marketplace, does Dr. Caris expect to see a surge of patients?
Possibly, or on the other side, they might be seeing the other normal doctors that file insurance, and then they'll be able to do less walk-ins, and they'll be busier, and so we'll see people for more urgent care walk-in type visits.
Dr. Caris says he's looking into accepting insurance because of healthcare reform. The Caris Clinic is one of 9,000 urgent care centers operating nationwide, with hundreds opening annually. And according to the Center for Studying Health System Change, a nonpartisan project based in Washington, D.C., more consumers are seeking them out. Dr. Caris says that's because the atmosphere at his clinic is less pressured.
Old-time medicine where the doctors enjoyed their patients and patients enjoyed their doctors.
35% of urgent care clinics are owned by physicians, another third by corporations, and 25% by hospitals. The rest operate as chains, and everyone is patronizing them.
Oh, that's from pediatric to geriatric.
Dr. Franz Rattucci is president of the American Academy of Urgent Care Medicine. He's worked in emergency medicine and urgent care and has started up urgent care centers which he says first appeared in the 1980s.
Back in those days, they were commonly called a doc in the box. It was a doctor that had a center, and you could just walk in, sort of like a McDonald's-type center. Over time, as physicians became more business savvy, as the landscape of technologies have changed, and as the landscape of consumerism has changed, so has the level of delivery of health care in urgent care centers changed.
The business of urgent care clinics is based on volume, so tend to be concentrated in suburbs and affluent metro areas, research shows. Urgent care clinic costs are on par with primary care costs, both of which exceed convenience care clinics, which have proliferated in shopping centers and big box stores. Those are staffed primarily by nurse practitioners and provide limited service. Retail clinic patients are often referred to urgent care centers, which are also catching on with investors, says Dr. Ritucci.
There is a lot of venture capital money out there. And as any business entity goes, they are buying up independent centers. Some centers are closing because of the, again, level of sophistication of competitors. So it's a very fluid market.
The Urgent Care Association of America says private equity firms see urgent care's potential due to a primary care physician shortage, with fewer medical students choosing careers in family practice.
Family practice or family practitioners are on the lower rung of reimbursements.
Medical school is extremely competitive and expensive, Dr. Ritucci says, and more young doctors are choosing to specialize because the money's better.
If someone elects to go into family practice, I applaud them. We all applaud them because we don't have enough of them. But the reimbursements to those physicians is not on par with, say, one who went into cardiology.
But those choosing to work in urgent care appear to be a certain breed.
I would say that they are physicians that have been either in family practice or have done emergency medicine for some time and are looking for a change in the dynamics on how they want to deliver care. Usually they're very highly energetic people that can see a multitude of different pathologies, different patients, and can see these patients in a short amount of time, but yet deliver quality care.
Dr. Ritucci says best management practices are in place for urgent care centers, and many seek accreditation.
One of the earmarks that one would look for would be, is the center accredited and by whom?
To keep costs low, Caris Clinic has opted to not pay annual accreditation fees. According to the Center for Studying Health System Change, the impact of urgent care centers on access and costs is not yet clear. Research also indicates that while urgent care centers cut into primary care business and disrupt continuity of care, hospitals and health systems with attached urgent care centers find they capture more patients, and insurance companies like them because they contain costs by keeping patients out of expensive ERs. Next year, millions more newly insured Americans will seek out routine medical care, with many qualifying for subsidies through their marketplaces. Two dozen states are also expanding Medicaid, with the Fed carrying the entire cost for the first few years. Arkansas has opted to utilize a private option, allowing 250,000 newly eligible to enroll in private health insurance coverage, which cover urgent care visits. And while most urgent care centers accept Medicare patients, many won't accept conventional Medicaid patients. The reimbursement rates are so low, they would cause centers to hemorrhage money. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
A short climb up Mount Sequoia and up a driveway that begins between two large pines. will take you to a house. This house once belonged to the late Eva Stalker. As you park your car and walk into the screened-in sitting room that overlooks the hills of East Fayetteville, you'll walk past a wooden sign, engraved with The Stalkers. Eva Stalker had no children, and her extended family was limited. So her will stated that the home should go to St. Paul's Episcopal Church and another area church. Jane Steinkraus is a parishioner at St. Paul's.
She particularly wanted it to be used for healing, which was something that she sought for many years towards the end of her life, and also for music ministry. And it's just a really beautiful place. I mean, I think it is. I think the view, I think the quiet, it's always quiet up here. I think that is a part of what makes it a healing place.
The home is now the location for St. Paul's Healing Touch Ministries. Healing Touch is an energy therapy in which practitioners consciously use their hands in a heart-centered and intentional way to support and facilitate mental, spiritual, physical, and emotional health and healing. The touch is lighter than massage, and often practitioners' hands don't even touch the client's body, but rather hover over it. Using a special series, the intent is to balance the body's energy, whatever part of them is out of equilibrium. Clients have a variety of issues, some with physical ailments, others mental or emotional.
Because people come in for all kinds of reasons, for grief, the loss of a loved one, chronic pain, multiple sclerosis, you name it, we see it.
Some clients come in for something as basic as a sprained ankle or as serious as cancer. The first just coming in for maybe a session or two. The second every week for years on end. The touch uses chakras and is similar to Reiki treatments. Though some say they do work miracles, Healing Touch is not, however, the evangelical miracle healing you often see on TV. Healing Touch is an internationally accredited program that was started by a nurse and originally taught only two nurses. Now it's open to anyone willing to learn. Holly Aaron is a massage therapist and St. Paul's Healing Touch Ministries coordinator. She explains that the training is a series of five workshops and takes years of dedication.
There are five levels. There's Healing Touch 1, 2, 3, and 4. 4 is in preparation to become a practitioner. So you're a student from 1 through 3. And then 4, you actually become a practitioner apprentice. And then between level 4 and 5, there's quite a lot of homework, including 100 documented sessions and book reviews, receiving other energetic modalities as comparison, and mentorship. And then at the end of that year, you can become a practitioner at Healing Touch Level 5. And then following that, you're ready for to submit for certification. And then you'd be certified by the Healing Touch program.
The 10 or so volunteer practitioners with St. Paul's vary in level of training, but all come from a field of healing. Some are physical therapists or counselors. Jane is a former nurse and nurse midwife. Drawing on both Eastern and Western medical traditions, doctors often refer patients to the Healing Touch Ministries, either to work in conjunction with their medical treatments or as a last resort. Further helping Jane's practice as a practitioner is the fact that she herself received treatments when she had a serious illness a few years back.
You know, I was really grateful when I got better, and but I feel like I can understand people who are going through illnesses a whole lot better than I could when I'd always been well. You know, you have a different, really visceral level, connection with them at that point.
Sessions last about an hour and require the practitioner to be grounded, centered, and attuned to the client, and require some prep, says Holly.
Grounding would be connecting to the earth energy and to the universal energy field, and allowing that to connect through you. At the point that you do that, you will usually feel your hands light up, and so you'll feel the energy in your hands. Centering is to kind of bring your energy and scattered thoughts all, bring them all home, bring them to, you know, where you are focused and centered and ready to only be present for your client. And then attuning is where you will connect with the client's energy field. And so that can be done by touch or by just entering their field with intention to attune to them.
I did receive a session from Holly and Jane. Sometimes they work together on one client, but not always. As I walk through the doorway into what was once a living room, but now holds three massage tables, the journalist in me wanted to record my session. The stressed out, frazzled, tired woman in me wanted to enjoy whatever was in store. Holly and Jane convinced this tired gal to enjoy. I took off my shoes and climbed under a blanket atop one of the tables, as Holly, too, removed her shoes and turned on some easy music. I closed my eyes as they began with the prayer. Healing touch is spiritual in nature, and as it is a ministry of St. Paul's, sessions do begin in prayer. But as clients do not have to be members of the church, practitioners are sensitive to spiritual beliefs.
For a lot of us, we do feel like prayer is a part of it, and that doesn't necessarily mean specifically Christian prayer, but just being really open to, I mean, I'd probably say the work of the Holy Spirit, but you could also say, you know, just healing energies.
Right. And in the intake process, there is a question, and the question is, what words do you use for higher power? So that then it's in the client's, it's in the client's words of whatever they use for higher power. So it's not, you know, not specific to any one. And that's in the intake for the healing touch when it's removed from St. Paul's.
I was so relaxed after my session, returning to the KUAF studios a completely different person than when I had left. David Wright has experienced a similar feeling. He's just been receiving healing touch for 4 weeks and tried it at the recommendation of his friend, Jane Steinkraus, whom he had called because of his incredibly high stress level.
Don't ask me how to explain how it works. I just know it does. And it has helped me so much in a number of ways, stress-wise, clarity in my head, and with freedom of movement of my shoulders and my jaw.
He says that when he first gets onto the table, he tries to focus on his breath and clear his mind of stress and be open to receive. It is energy healing, and David says that he can feel the energy, even when their hands are not on his body.
My eyes were closed, but I knew exactly, two people were working on me, and I knew exactly where their hands were at all times. Now, that's, you know, that's the energy that was exchanged. And I can't, it's hard to explain, but I could tell where they were at every moment.
It's a sensation that remains long after he returns home, a feeling he likens to icy hot, warm yet chilling. Bud Planchin is a cancer patient. He has had numerous surgeries, going into remission 3 times, yet it has returned again. He began healing touch after making a promise to a dear friend who was in hospice care. With a background in emergency medical services, he had a linear way of thinking when it came to his treatments and was skeptical at first, but quickly became a believer when he left so relaxed. He can't put it into qualitative terms, but says healing touch forces him to do an hour of meditation each week and helps him sleep so much better that night.
There's times I go in there and I am frazzled because my regular day for chemo is on a Wednesday. And so, I mean, and by Friday, I'm so tired and everything, but I can't sleep because of the medication and stuff, and I'll just fall asleep, boom. And it's a wonderful feeling to be able to relax and not think about the illness.
In addition to sleeping better and the mental healing, it lessens Bud's pain.
I've had several surgeries, and because of the surgeries and the locations of the surgeries, I have a lot of adhesions and scar tissue, and sometimes they really become painful, and it does release a lot of that pain sometimes, and, you know, it helps a lot.
Whether stress or cancer, Jane is confident in the positive effects of healing touch.
And we see it all the time. We see people come in, you know, very stressed, very anxious, not able to sleep, with pain, whatever, and leave saying things like, I haven't felt this relaxed in months. At some point, the pain just went away. I slept well. You know, they'll come back, I slept well this week.
The Healing Touch Ministries of St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Fayetteville is a free service to anyone in the community, and all practitioners are volunteers. For more information, visit stpaulsfay.org. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
You can hear great jazz right here on KUAF every Friday and Saturday night. Hello, I'm Robert Ginsberg, and my show, Shades of Jazz, can be heard Friday and Saturday nights from 10 till midnight. On Friday night, Daniel Estes steps in at midnight till 1 o'clock with Goodnight Jazz, and on Saturdays, it's Fred Hall taking in the midnight to 1 o'clock hour with Swing Thing. Tune in to KUAF for great jazz.
This is Ozarks at Large. Here's a mental exercise to try. Make a list of the significant economic segments of the Northwest Arkansas economy. Certainly, retail plays a big role. Walmart and the legion of associated vendors located here has a large impact on the economy. Food processing, trucking and logistics, education and tourism, too. Chances are you didn't list the military. While not one of the larger parts of the economic equation in Benton and Washington counties, a recent report compiled by the Northwest Arkansas Council found that the annual contribution to the two counties from military-related factors is more than $150 million. Troy Galloway, the Community and Economic Development Director for Bentonville, says recognition of the military's importance might not be, as he puts it, front and center for many, but he says it's indeed an important presence.
When you start to peel the onion back just a little bit, you begin to realize when you look at the Veterans Administration Services, the hospital, the Arkansas Army National Guard, even the Army Reserve, and all of these other smaller parts that collectively add up to be a fairly significant part of our economy.
Troy Galloway is also the commander of the Arkansas National Guard's 142nd Fires Brigade, based in Fayetteville. It has more than 1,300 soldiers from all over Northwest Arkansas, including more than 800 who live in the two counties covered in the report.
And I think what people recognized through the media, through personal accounts over the last decade, is that the soldiers in this brigade have deployed multiple times to Iraq, to Afghanistan, to Kuwait, to the Middle East in various forms, and have supplemented an army that has been strained over a decade of war and that desperately needed these folks to step up, and they've done it time and time again.
Rob Smith, a communications and policy specialist with the Northwest Arkansas Council, prepared the report on the military's economic impact locally. He says those soldiers in the region are earning paychecks that stretch their spending across the area.
For many people that are in the National Guard, it's a second income, but it's also a lot of discretionary money. If you have a job like Troy in the community working for the city of Bentonville, you know, that's money they can spend and ultimately create other jobs, services, you know, retail, all those things, all that spending that occurs.
Smith says the money added to the region's economy from military checks doesn't only come from active members of the Army and the National Guard. The Northwest Arkansas Council's report says nearly 32,000 veterans have made homes in the two counties. That's about 7% of the overall population.
That's a significant number. Certainly the VA hospital is a huge factor. When you talk to veterans, many of them have located here specifically because those services are available. But, you know, one of the, you know, fly under radar kind of stats you think about, or don't, maybe you don't think about, is that the VA, the system we have in Fayetteville and in the clinics, they spend another $30 million at other hospitals in the region. And the reason they do that is because they don't want those veterans to wait on a service that they can't perform there. They don't want them to have to get on a waiting list at Little Rock. They need it faster. So that benefits Washington Regional. It benefits certainly the Mercy system. It benefits our hospitals. I mean, that's a good fly-under-the-radar stat that I kind of ran into.
The report estimates those services provided by other hospitals to veterans in Northwest Arkansas worth about $33 million. Rob Smith says a recent $74 million expansion at the Veterans Administration in Fayetteville wasn't tallied in the report and could push the military's role in the local economy well past the $150 million figure. He says the council will issue other reports about specific economic factors in the region, though there isn't a timetable for when those will be finished. He says the council became interested in the military impact on the local economy in part because some of the largest companies here are making public commitments to hire more veterans.
You know, Walmart announced that they want to hire 100,000 veterans, and they've already hit 20,000. We've seen Tyson Foods hire 1,200 veterans. And if you look at the proportion of employees, 1,200 is a similar percentage to what Walmart has. Those are big numbers. J.B. Hunt was recognized by GI Jobs magazine as a good place for veterans. So certainly their interest and their interest in helping veterans helped really encourage the Northwest Arkansas Council to want to take a look at what do they mean in our two counties.
Troy Galloway, the commander of the National Guard's 142nd Fires Brigade and a member of the economic development team in Bentonville, says he had never really thought about the exact impact military services have in this corner of the state. He says $150 million or so dollars may not be a large part of what's estimated by the Northwest Arkansas Council to be a $20 billion economy here, but he says there is value beyond the statistics. He says the National Guard has been part of efforts following a massive tornado in Mena, flooding in southwestern Arkansas in the past few years, and just this month after a winter storm hit the region.
We had soldiers on state active duty that were augmenting and supplementing local emergency responders, driving the highways of northwest Arkansas, helping motorists that might have needed some assistance. We pushed out some generators to a couple of nursing homes that were requiring additional power when they lost power for periods of time. And so those are the sorts of things that obviously impact people, they impact organizations, and I guess in some way, even though it's hard to quantify, it does indirectly impact the economy.
There is a link to the entire new report about military economic impact on Northwest Arkansas at our webpage, ozarksatlarge.com.
Last weekend marked the one-year anniversary of the shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. The effects of the massacre touched many around the globe, the nation, and the region. Lifelong Fayetteville resident David Lewis lost his grandson. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda spoke with Lewis about a bell-ringing ceremony last weekend to commemorate the event.
I have a history with that church. I grew up in Fayetteville and went to that church as a young kid, and I can remember that it was a thrill to me as a six-year-old to be able to ring the bell. And I got to ring the bell occasionally. That may have been an incentive to get me to go to church. But as a six-year-old, the bell was so heavy it would actually pull me off the ground, if I remember correctly. This was a few years ago.
Well, those things can be very large, and I'm sure it did, in fact, pull you off the ground.
It is large. So I'll find out how large it is by ringing it tomorrow.
What were the conversations like for you when you were approached about doing this, as you have your own personal connection to the event versus just a citizen who, you know,
well,
parishioner who wanted to ring the bell?
You know, it's been a long, it's hard to believe a year's gone by, but it's been from tomorrow's date last year began a very difficult time in all of our lives. So ringing the bell is certainly more special to me than it would be to somebody else, because I was very close to it, very touched by it, and went through the whole process of watching the city of Newtown bury their 26 people over the course of about a week, and it was a pretty rough time for sure. But my daughter has come out of it. She started the Jesse Lewis Choose Love Foundation, which is really about teaching kids about wisdom, about how to be happy, about being grateful, about how to choose love over anger, about things that I don't think are really taught in most schools today to make it a better place, to make it a more peaceful place. And that was her wish to honor her son, and it's been her salvation, I think, to go someplace other than anger and resentment over the fact that her son was killed. So she's been able to rise above it by really working at being grateful and choosing love over anger.
What kind of conversations did you and your daughter Scarlett have about the foundation? Did she talk to you at all about her decision to start the foundation?
I really told her that's what she should do with the rest of her life, and we talked about it, and of course she at the time had a lot of misgivings about everything, you know, and she was due to go back to work. I said, no, you've got to pursue this. This is something you can do that'll be a life's work that will make the world a better place. And she's taken it and so far funded it and moved in that direction, and she's been motivated. She says she's been pushed by Jesse's spirit to do these positive things. And I think that's very true. I think that's true.
So with the foundation, how do you reach out to others? How do you teach that message of love? You guys are trying to do it through educational programs in schools?
Well, that's what we would like to do. And the exact plan is uncertain. is how best to reach kids. I mean, we could produce, and we have produced a video about survivors of the Rwandan genocide, which is an interesting story because during the first week after the tragedy, we got in touch by Skype with some Rwandan genocide victims who wanted to express their condolences and love to particularly JT, who was 13 years old, and to Scarlett. So these people are 21, 22 years old. The genocide was in 1994. And they told their stories through an interpreter of what they had been through and that forgiveness and love would lead had led them to a happy place. And they had the most wonderful, gentle smiles on their face. And their stories were absolutely horrific. I mean, they were, you know, all their family was killed, and they were the only one there as a five-year-old to make their way in the world. So it was inspirational at the time to Scarlett and JT because it would be easy to fall into your own trap of the world's been unkind to me, and, you know, and I'm angry about it. But here, I mean, you couldn't imagine a worse story, and these kids had risen above it. So it was really a great thing to do. And we're doing a little documentary on this effort in Rwanda, hoping that we can create a curriculum around it and show it to schools where, you know, really there are a lot of lessons in this, but certainly a lesson is in gratitude. You know, it's certainly a lesson in love and a lesson in forgiveness. And simple wisdom that these kind of examples, I think, can bring the world that can't help but be positive for our young kids. And that's, we hope to do that in several different ways, maybe by using also modern ways to communicate with an eighth grader, you know, which may not necessarily be a video. It may be through a lot of other new type means of media conversations where they can actually interact. And so this is kind of an ongoing, how do we do this kind of deal. And the educational system, of course, is pretty well set in the way they think they should do things. So you're not going to go in and turn the world upside down overnight. But if you could do it from the ground up or from the grassroots up, that would really be neat. So that's the effort. That's the challenge.
Well, it's a good challenge. And like you said, it's a bit of a challenge. Is it particularly more challenging trying to do something that's, say, a change in attitude as opposed to a change in legislation? Because I know something that came out of this was folks talking about, you know, gun legislation one way or the other. And here you're coming up with this concept of not being angry, you know, and choosing love instead of being angry and forgiveness and things like that. Is it a little more, I guess, difficult to explain that to someone, that that's your goal, and then maybe even changing people's minds?
A little bit, but, you know, let's think about it for a second. A symptom of the illness is using drugs, is being in jail, is shooting somebody else. And how do you treat the illness? You go back and teach love. If you really want to solve these problems, you got to start at the source of the illness, and that's anger, and the child is not based in love. And so I wish that I had, at 12 years old or 14 years old, somebody had told me, you don't have to be angry. You know, you don't have to carry anger around. Hey, it's a toxic mix. It's not a fun thing to do. So I think tell kids that. Tell them they don't have to be victims of the world, because victims of the world fill our prisons. So they have an alternative. They can be personally responsible, and going that route creates their own personal peace. Simple message, but I'm not sure how many times it's given. You know, it's just simply the truth. Now, can you prove it like 2 + 2 = 4? Maybe not, but it's common sense.
Can you tell me a little bit about your daughter's book? I understand the title was inspired by something that your grandson actually wrote.
He did. She lives in a little farmhouse in Sandy Hook. I think the farmhouse was built in about, I think, 1750. It's been added on to. But anyway, there's a wall in the kitchen that's actually a chalkboard. And after the tragedy, Scarlett lived with her mother for 2 weeks before she ever even went back into the house. And when she did go back into the house, she found on this chalkboard a message that Jesse had written in six-year-old spelling and basically six-year-old looking letters, It said nurturing, healing, love. It was just there. She'd never seen it before. So it was just, she just took it as a message. And so she sent me out to get a piece of plexiglass, which we now put up over that message so that it'll always be there. But that on the cover of the book is basically a picture of his handwriting, Nurturing, Healing, Love. And that's where the title of the book came from. But the book is about her experience from day one until we had a birthday party for Jesse in June. So many people said to her, I couldn't do that. She said, well, yeah, you could. You just don't know it. You know, I mean, yeah, I've got to survive. I mean, it's very difficult, and I can see how you'd feel that way, but it's learning to accept what's real. I mean, that's one of our biggest challenges in life, accepting whatever comes to us, you know, even though it's difficult.
What do you hope that someone would take away from a memorial? I know what it means for you, but what does it mean for, you know?
Well, I have these little bracelets, and on them, it says choose love.
Mm-hmm.
And my daughter at the funeral, now this is a week after her son had been killed, her message at her son's funeral was to all of us, and this is, if there's something to take away from it, it's this. She said, if a lot of you have asked me what you can do for me, and I'm going to tell you what you can do for me. You can change one angry thought to a loving one every day. If we do this, we can change the world, and an event like this will be far less likely to occur. She's asking you to take away and make an effort to. You may have to wear a little bracelet that says choose love. But when you want to get angry, just think about that. You know, choose love over anger. You'll be happier, and you'll make the world a better place. So
that was David Lewis inside Studio 123 Friday afternoon. You can find out more information at jesselewischooselove.org.
Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda conducted that interview for a daily edition of Ozarks at Large.
Good morning. It is Sunday, December 22nd, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
Joining us now is Becca Martin Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Eep!
What? 3 days before Christmas? Uh-huh.
Was that a little bit of panic there?
Oh, yeah. No, that's a lot of panic.
Okay.
3 shopping days.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I got stuff to do. Let's talk fast. Okay. This time of year, What's Up always does a top 10 stories of the year.
Right. Arts and entertainment related.
Exactly. And so on Friday, we counted down 10, 9, 8, 7, and 6.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to do that today. And then next Friday, we will do 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Okay.
So number 10 is the recovery of the Passion Play.
It was all but gone.
And that was at the end of the year in 2012. The final show of the 2012 season was almost the final show ever. And they managed to come up with $75,000 to pay interest on some loans. And we're back in business for 2013.
And how is their health now? Do we know?
Their health is wonderful, they say. They have plans for the new year that includes the Jerusalem Marketplace, which they're calling an interactive exhibit like Silver Dollar City in Bible days.
Okay.
And they will also have more and larger gospel concerts starting next summer and ways for the audience to participate in the Passion Play.
Like a walk-on roll or something?
I don't know.
Okay.
We'll
stay
find
tuned.
Out.
Okay.
Opening night is May 2nd, 2014, so we'll find out.
Okay.
Our number 9 story is transitions.
Into
people
what?
Who came and went.
Oh, okay.
John Burroughs replacing Gabe Bland after 22 years
right.
at the Rogers Historical Museum.
Forgot right. about that one.
And Michael Rea replacing Andy Gibbs.
Yes, at the drama department.
Chairman of the drama department at the university. Rod Bigelow replacing Don Bocciagalupi.
Right.
Kind of. Don Bocciagalupi moved up into a newly created position at Crystal Bridges. And Barb Putman taking over as executive director of the Community Creative Center.
That's right. And then Jim Swigert, late in the year.
Just found that out,
right.
that he's retiring from Opera in the Ozarks.
Right.
So, number 8 is the Fort Smith Symphony turns 90.
Yeah, so they don't look a season over 70.
They really don't. Number seven is the great mud apocalypse of Wakarusa.
I did not participate in that this year.
They had 20,000 plus participants, more than 100 bands, and ended up with 600 to 800 tents abandoned where they fell.
It looked like a mess.
Where they were blown
pictures.
In two, right?
Exactly, yeah. And mud and a tornado in the area. And
shoes stuck in the mud, too. I think they found a lot of shoes afterward.
And then they had to recover and do the country music festival in like 2 weeks.
And wasn't the weather for that just like spot on, beautiful?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So,
I think it was less than 2 weeks.
Yeah.
1 week.
Yeah.
And number six is the debut of the Stieglitz Collection at Crystal Bridges.
Yes, highly anticipated and still ongoing.
I still haven't made it.
I haven't either. Mm. But I'm going to go over the holidays because there's lots of fun stuff. I talked to Nikki Stewart about it, and mm-hmm. there's lots of fun ways to look at it. Not just as it's this amazing collection that is finally here, but in relationship to the things permanently at Crystal Bridges.
And it's a bridge between a couple of art eras. Mm-hmm. You know, it was part of the modern art explosion that happened 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And between Europe and America.
Yes, absolutely.
So it's been a big year for Crystal Bridges. You'll see them again in the top five when mm-hmm. we talk on the 27th.
Okay, very good.
And now I think there's something I have to remember to say. Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas.
I gotta go now!
This is the last time we will talk to you until after Christmas.
No, we'll talk on Monday.
Well, you and Christina will.
Okay.
I won't talk to you then. So
okay.
I'll see you tomorrow.
I'm going to tell you right now, Merry Christmas.
All right, then.
Okay, very good.
And Happy New Year.
And all of that, all of
Feliz
it.
Feliz Navidad, and I've got to go shopping.
Yes.
Bye, guys.
Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
During the holidays, it's easy to lose sight of what it is we're celebrating.
One of the most important things I can do while I'm on this planet is honor those I love through celebrations.
I'm Lynn Neary. Join me for Tinsel Tales 2, stories that bring the holiday season into focus in a Christmas program from NPR.
Listen to Tinsel Tales Christmas Day from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on KUAF.
Each Thursday evening, a group of 15 or so women and men, ranging in ages from 19 to, well, much older, meet for Knit Night at Handheld, a yarn shop on Block Street in Fayetteville. I arrive on a blustery and snowy eve, and just five ladies surround an oval table in the center of a long and narrow room full of yarn in every color and texture imaginable. I am quickly offered a glass of wine, to which I immediately accept, and a round of friendly toasts begins.
Here's to those that wish us well. All the rest can go to hell.
Amen.
Amen. Amen.
Yes.
Yeah, you should know a toast in Spanish.
Though knitting is pretty much a solo hobby, something that can be done with your feet up in front of the fireplace, and is sometimes easier to do at home if you have a difficult pattern and lots of yarn, the companionship is what most come to Knit Night for. Knitter Jane says that talking to new friends about a similar interest has its benefits.
This group is basically on the same level that I am, so it's bounce pattern ideas off each other. Talk about different things, inspire each other, help each other solve problems, and not always with knitting needles.
She says it reminds her of the old quilting bees women used to have during colonial times. Jane is a recently retired CPA who moved to the area just over a year ago. She was thrilled to come to Northwest Arkansas, where Handheld is just one of three yarn stores. This is where she found the yarn for the sweater she is currently working on. She had purchased the pattern from England nearly 7 years ago, taking her that long to find the perfect green to match her kilt.
It's basically built on a short jacket, which is very popular, and like I said, a Celtic knot, which is the intertwined cables that go in and out. It's almost like the old love knot that was in Victorian times. And then I've got small cables, they call them, that separate the two. And I liked this pattern particularly because when you get to one side of the front, the cables mirror what they are on the other side, so that you add a little bit of extra design touch that you don't get on your store-bought garments.
Funny that it took Jane so long to find that perfect yarn. She has a yarn room, much like another knitter I know, containing a stash that she will probably never use in her lifetime.
They call it SABLE, Stage Acquisition Beyond Life Expectancy.
Jane has calculated that if she knits at the rate she's going, she will be 187 years old when she's finished with the yarn she has. Yet, she continues to acquire more. Knitting is a series of loops on loops, one row at a time, moving one loop from one needle and using a needle to pull the yarn through that loop, the size of the needle determining the size of the row and the pattern. But have you ever seen needles as large as your arm? Cynthia Parker is the owner and proprietor of Handheld. After rolling a skein of green merino wool into a ball, using her knees as a guide, she ties slip knots around her wrists to get started.
You pull this loop over onto this hand, and you feed the yarn through it, and that makes a stitch. So I'm feeding the loop through the stitch, and that's been knitted. Feed the loop through the stitch.
It takes her just less than 30 minutes to make an infinity scarf with large and floppy loops bearing goat hair flowers. Though this technique is relatively new, at just a couple of years, Cynthia started knitting at 5 years old and remembers her great-grandmother teaching her.
We both got in trouble. It was Thanksgiving and we were both in trouble. And so they kind of, she was probably like 95. And my great-grandmother McDonald. And so they sat us both in the corner and she taught me.
Cynthia started with a very primitive slipper, moving on to Barbie clothes and now human clothes, some of which hang from the ceiling of her store. These pieces are samples of what you can do with a particular yarn, but are also for sale. She has been knitting since that Thanksgiving day, though she did have to take a hiatus because knitting had injured her. That's right, a knitting injury.
I did hurt myself knitting. I hurt my neck. And so I stopped for about 8 or 9 years. I know. And you know what it was? I needed glasses.
So how did you hurt your neck knitting?
All scrunched over and...
Cynthia isn't the original owner of Handheld, though the first time she walked into it at its original location on East Avenue, she said, I'm going to work here someday. And she did. She began by teaching workshops and such until the previous owners and friends decided to retire, though those two still attend knit nights. Joanne Phillips is not one of the former owners and also not what she calls a consistent knitter. The reddish-brown sweater she is making for her son-in-law, number two, is just the fourth sweater she has ever knitted. She calls herself a novice, yet she is anything but making the sweater without a pattern.
I go by the measurements of their waist and shoulders and neck and everything and arm length, and then go by the gauge of my needle and my yarn together. So I don't know that it's more difficult. Yes, basically I am designing a sweater. It sounds difficult, but I would consider myself a very novice knitter. There's some real talent that comes here, and I would not consider myself even close to that. No.
Joanne says the knit pearl pattern of stitches is pretty simple, though she is proud of the work she is doing. This fourth project, she hasn't had to rip out and start over. She's anxious to knit something for herself next, though she never thought of herself as a sweater person.
Everything itches me. You know, I've learned new terminology. It is not the fabric that's itching me. It's the bloom. It's that those little fibers that come off of it that tickle, you know. So I don't know what I'm going to knit yet, but there's all kinds of yarn in here that doesn't have a bloom on it. So I will probably silk.
You can hear the camaraderie that occurs at knit night. Everyone chiming in the conversation, or not, that's okay too, helping one another out. Even Sasha, the black shop cat, made an appearance, rubbing against her owner's legs as she arm knitted. Though I'm not a knitter, I too was immediately accepted. And when I'm ready to learn, I know where to go. Handheld will offer workshops in the coming year, in addition to one-on-one teaching by appointment Tuesday through Friday. For more information, visit handheldknitting.com.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. Earlier this month, two members of the band Early Morning Bourbon Girls came to the Furman Garner Performance Studio. The band is having a reunion show on Saturday night, December 28th at Maxine's Tap Room. Here are Rebecca Champagne and Meredith Martin Motes, the founders of the Early Morning Bourbon Girls, singing an original song of Meredith's titled Mountain Lion. Meredith Martin Motes and Rebecca Champagne are the founders of the band Early Morning Bourbon Girls. Many of the original band members will be together for a reunion show Saturday night at Maxine's Tap Room. It is a free show. That was recorded inside Furman Garner Performance Studio.
Do you know how many members they actually have?
It varied from time to time. They got up to about a dozen or more at one point. Right. And they're about half of them are going to be back.
All right. Well, this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Westville, Oklahoma.
Westville, Oklahoma. You have the show tomorrow.
I do.
The Christmas Eve show is what we record at the Fayetteville Public Library.
Right.
Noon and 7.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Thanks for listening.
Yes.